This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
We have no idea which one's going to work.
We don't know if any of them will work.
If he uses anything he took from that left case, he's dead anyway.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematic Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Today, we are going to go over some of our favourite and least favourite science tropes in movies. We'll go over some news very briefly first, give you a kind of update on what was meant to happen last week, why it's not happening, and then we'll get stuck into some of these tropes, including, but not limited to, scientists coming up with a theory on the spot, scientists using microscopes incorrectly, and lazy writing and plot devices. As always, the show will be broken up into those segments. We'll have time codes below, so skip ahead to whatever you're looking for. But before we get into that, my name's Sam Perrin. I'm an invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside host Adam Harsik, a parasite/disease ecologist at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. Alongside Adam is the Baroness.
Lebe.
Give me a corner.
I can't do that.
Bloody Welsh.
Oh, ladyship, Libby Young. Our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup. Dave is,
Dave and Scott Sigler apparently got sucked up into an alternate universe this week.
Oh, okay.
Or are we in the alternate universe?
Nice.
Maybe.
Well, we'll find out when they come back. Maybe they'll be able to tell us whether or not Nelson Mandela is still alive and or... No, hang on. Nelson Mandela would definitely be dead in that universe as well, right?
Probably, but maybe tell us if OJ went to jail and if it's Berenstain or Barnstein Bears. Or Bernstein, whichever one it is.
They're the ones, yeah. Yeah, so we had promised that this week was going to be an episode with New York Times bestselling author Scott Sigler. However, we had some scheduling conflicts, so we're going to push that to in 2 weeks' time. In the meantime, today we're going to talk about some of our favourite and, like I said, at least favourite scientific tropes. Something we did a couple of seasons ago, but we've got some more to go over. And we're going to do Shang-Chi next week, and then we'll have Scott on the week after that.
Yes.
So, news this week, a case that has been grating on Adam and my mind.
It's on my mind. It's on your
so
mind.
So, news this,
on the
news this
mind. Mind.
Yeah. News this week, a case that has been grating on our minds for the past... 2 years?
About 2 years when this first started coming up.
Yeah. Almost.
Wow. I realize it's been that long.
Yeah. So, Adam, you want to take us through it?
Yeah. So, as longtime listeners might be aware, and also frequenters of Ecology for the Masses, Jonathan Pruitt, formerly of, well, currently still, I guess, of McMaster University in Canada, was accused of and found to be faking data in a variety of his publications. Basically, there were some concerns by some co-authors of his, not just people that were out there in the field who just found these things. People he worked with saw some of the data, thought it was suspect. They brought some issues up to Jonathan. He's like, blah, 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 kind of hand-waved it all away. They didn't like it. They tried doing, there's basically statistical tests you can do to kind of see, is this data, is there actually like a good chance that it is true, like randomly acquired data from like a group? Or did someone do what Jonathan did and literally take about 20 rows of an Excel sheet and copy it below and then copy that below and then copy that below. It's like if you had a block that said ABC and then you just copied ABC and then you copied ABC and you're like, oh yeah, this is totally random. Of course this is random. And this was dozens of papers have had this. So he's had multiple papers retracted, much to his protest. He lawyered up. There was a whole thing about it. A couple different journals have concluded their investigations into him. And it was not until today that Sam and I found out that finally McMaster University, this very prestigious university that he holds a very prestigious position at, officially removed him from his... Well, they put him on paid administrative leave. He can't use the research funds, he can't do research, and he can't conduct his lab, basically. But he's still being paid,
and he's had
and
his,
he still has a position.
And he's had his PhD withdrawn.
Yes.
Which is...
He's had his thesis withdrawn.
Monumental. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And... We want to reiterate, because this isn't just one man who's, you know, had these punishments meted out to him. what he did jeopardized other people's careers, because you've got early career researchers on there. You've got other people like Kate Laskowski, who had some of her earliest papers withdrawn because she was a co-author with Pruitt. And tons of other early career researchers who published papers with him had their papers withdrawn. If you are early in your career, those might be 40% of your papers all of a sudden gone. That can affect your job prospects.
Those could be your biggest papers.
Yeah. And on top of that, all these other people who didn't get grants or any other sorts of funding that went to this guy because he had falsified data and was, you know, awarded more money on the basis that he'd done quote-unquote terrific research before, they missed out. Their careers had massive setbacks. So, yeah, this isn't just a really... this isn't an isolated incident. This affects a lot of people. And there's already been two more high-profile cases since this one broke. Yep. People falsifying data.
So, we mentioned it two weeks ago with Dead & Start. So, who knows where these are all going to go. Don't fake your data, kids.
Yeah.
Data is what the data is. Write a good story about it, whether the results are what you want or not. Speaking of writing a good story... Jonathan is taking to a bit of a pivot in his career and apparently is dedicating himself towards writing fantasy fiction, which I cannot remember who it was on Twitter, but somebody had one of the best...
Dan Baldassar.
Yes, he had the best scathing comeback of like, oh, this is going to be too much of a stretch for him.
Yeah. He just comes out with a novel next year wonderful. Called Lady of the Rings.
Yeah. Oh, Dan, where did I go wrong? Oh... I think it's pretty clear where you went wrong, but for future reference, you might want to copy the content of the paper into a Word document rather than printing it straight off the Hotmail webpage. That makes it pretty clear that it was an email.
Before we get stuck into some of the scientific tropes we want to discuss today, if you have any thoughts or questions or suggestions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Harsic Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit the website, cinematicanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. You can also chat or game with us on Discord. Just type in Cinematica Animalia and you'll find us. If you want to read Libby's work, as always, visit shortstoriesoup.substack.com and sign up for fortnightly emails with new stories. And if you want to hear some of the less movie-related ecology that Adam, myself, and a huge team of international writers write about, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com. So, first trope we wanted to discuss today was this thing that pervades almost any movie with an ounce of biology in it, which is a scientist just coming up with an idea on the spot with very little precedent for that idea popping into their head, and everybody else just going with it and accepting.
And then being incredibly certain of their idea.
Yeah. Now, this sometimes works. And there are even instances where I think it's done quite well. We've talked earlier in the season about Annihilation with Kirsty MacLeod. How there are some postulations made throughout that movie about what could be happening. And although the conclusion is agreed upon a little too early, there is actually people who go and test that theory. Natalie Portman grabs a microscope, more on use of microscopes later,
yes.
And, you know, looks at some cells and sees a theory confirmed, right? Again, in that situation, I do feel like they go with this a little too quickly, but...
They do go this too quickly.
At least it's being tested.
I do want to jump in there real quick because of a topic we might bring up later, but she confirms a hypothesis, not a theory.
Yeah.
There's an important distinction we'll talk about later.
And it's not like they're going with that. They make massive, huge decisions based on that throughout the rest of the film. It's just something that's brought up that is given as an explanation to the audience. Right. And Libby, if you have something like that where, you know, there's just a theory that's put forward, right, about why this is happening, do you think we're always supposed to interpret that as fact within the movie?
I mean, I tend to be a literalist when it comes to story. I like things that represent more accurate life. So I tend to favor in movies where science isn't just, like you guys are saying, this trope of they just say it and it's fact. I like, for your example of Annihilation, where she, you know, albeit very short and brief, tests her theory. So I think the more that you can ground a story in that realism, you know, fantasy genre sort of excluded from that. But if you're doing a realistic movie, for sure, the more that your audience will believe that story. So I think that it's harder on audiences to just take the face value of whatever the scientist is saying and just be like, yep, this is it. Because, you know, the characters in the movie or show are doing the same thing, right? They're like, oh, okay, yeah, we don't have a brain. Sure, that sounds good.
You're a handy pod device.
And it's telling your audience the same thing. Like, you don't have a brain either. You should just believe what I tell you.
Yeah. Okay. My favorite, and I go on about this all the time to anybody who'll listen, is King of the Monsters, the Godzilla film that came 2015? Out in, what,
2017,
maybe, yeah. Yeah, where constantly throughout that movie, you have these just extravagant, ridiculous theories being thrown out there all the time. People just stating them as facts. Like, for instance, Kaiser Ghidorah being an invasive species.
Yeah.
Or Godzilla being able to communicate fluently with all these other monsters.
And being the alpha.
Being the alpha. These concepts that are just put out there, rammed down our throats, and we're supposed to accept them as believable science. Now, in fairness, I've spoken to Trav and Michael about this, the guys who we know over at Kaiju Weekly, right? And they appreciate that in some sense. And, I mean, obviously that's because they admitted themselves they're not well-versed in biology. Here's another example. Reading Michael Crichton books, right? When I read Jurassic Park and Jurassic Park 2 or The Lost World, whatever they call it.
Lost World.
I was like, this is all absolute... Yeah, this is absolute crap, okay? I hate all this and your understanding of biology and science is very poor, right? Then I read Timeline where he talks about quantum physics the whole time. I have no idea whether or not that's crap as well because I know nothing about quantum physics. So, do you think it's just that we're such picky assholes, Adam, that we...
I can confirm that I am a picky asshole. I know that about movies. Yeah. But I think, for me, it's one of those things where the reason Godzilla, King of the Monsters fails is because it tries to do too much or it tries to explain too much. It's the same problem you have with any piece of fiction that tries to do time travel and tries to then explain why this one works and this one doesn't. Or any kind of, you know, out there, quote, fake science. If you just do it and you kind of brush it away and it just works in the movie and it's good for the story, excellent. I don't really care that much because it's not that important that I know how all these mechanisms work. But if Godzilla King of the Monsters or I'm struggling to think of a good time travel example that I despise because I really enjoyed the German show Dark. But if you try to then get down the nitty gritty of all, explain how all these different things work and provide like rules for the universe, it's like, I don't need this. And because you're doing this, you're just giving me all these examples or all these different holes that I can then poke with my picky asshole fingers and just hate every bit of it.
It is always going to be inevitably more difficult to buy into a show when you are an expertise on the subject matter. So, for example, I had an ex-partner who was a police officer in a former life. And when we watched shows or movies that had police scenes in it, every time he's just like, oh my god, I can't with this bullshit. You know, and it's stuff that some of the stuff had bothered me before because I knew from my basic knowledge of you know, how police operate, that was like, I don't think that they do that. But after he explained some of the things, now even, you know, years later, whenever I see this thing, that trope in shows or movies, it drives me nuts. You know, the police officer rushing into a dangerous situation and not waiting for backup. They fucking never do that. You know, my other favorite one is when they take shelter behind anything that a bullet would always travel through. You know, like cars. Yeah, the only thing that's going to stop a bullet in a car is the engine block. So if you're hiding behind a car door, you're fucking dead. So, you know,
I always enjoy it when they tip tables up.
Exactly.
Like, is the table made of like Kevlar?
There's that balance of, you know, you guys are experts in your field. And so you are going to see things that most normal plebeians would not notice. but there is a balance between, you know, that suspense of belief. And then also, you know, in the writing world, we have a famous saying is show, don't tell, right? So when you, to Adam's point, like when you start to tip that balance where you're cramming so much information down the audience's throat by telling them and just being like, nope, you need to know this, you need to know this, you need to know this. I think that's when, to me, to my point earlier, you start to call your audience an idiot, or, you know, just say like, this plot is so dense that we cannot show it. We have to tell you. And to me, that gets so convoluted. Yeah. It becomes kind of boring. You just check out.
Yeah. And I will say that a lot of the time I don't care about this sort of stuff. I've got two examples at either end, where one is just ridiculous, one is great, and I love it. One that's in the middle for me, where the science is ridiculous, but I don't care, is The Amazing Spider-Man, the first Andrew Garfield one, where they're using, you know, lizards or geckos or any type of kind of lizard that has an ability to regrow a limb to regrow a human limb. It's ridiculous, and they mention it a couple of times. They're like, we're taking this ability from an animal, trying to put it into a human. Of course it's absurd. But I don't really care about it because they don't go into explaining it too much. It's just some fancy graphics. And, you know, I like that movie. I don't love it, but I like that movie. And I don't really care about that. But potentially because I do like that movie.
It also helps you're living in a world where the shit's insane to begin with, and they're totally okay with that. Yeah. Unlike King of the Monsters, where they're trying to act like, oh, no, this is real. And, like, this is how the science would work, if these monsters were real.
And you don't need to do that with Godzilla. Like, it's just... I actually...
A giant fucking lizard. Nothing's real. Just have fun.
Don't get me wrong. The 98 film is much worse. Oh, I think King of the Monsters... I don't know. I really don't like King of the Monsters. But they don't mess around with that sort of crap in the 98 version. It's just like, an iguana. It's a big iguana. Get over it.
I like the 98 version. But it's cheesy.
Yeah, it is very cheesy, but there's a lot of, like, I wrote an article for the Kaiju Weekly guys on it this week. There is a lot of dumb fun to be had.
But you had Jean Reno being the Frenchest French you could ever French. What more do you need?
Yeah, just the Frenchest of French man. Just sipping French roast and quaffing croissants.
What was it you said in the piece that you had me read where you said all of his mates probably named Francois?
But the most bonkers example of this that I've found is The Happening. The biology teacher, Mark Wahlberg, is like, it's the trees.
Oh, someone with the plants.
And we're expected to just...
Someone with the plants. Say hello to your mom.
Some chicken. Just want to talk to you for a little bit.
Yeah. And that is, to me, the dumb... Because it's not like it's gone into on a massive level. Like, it's not like they try to explain it with pseudoscience, but it is such a dumb conclusion to come to out of nowhere.
Well, I mean, your first mistake was having Mark Wahlberg as a sellable teacher.
Yeah. We've talked about this for too long. The last example I really wanted to point out, which I thought was great, is Arrival.
Yes.
We've talked about Denis Villeneuve's Dune recently, but in that movie, and I know it's mainly linguistic science that they're going over, but they are constantly testing and reaffirming what they think throughout it. And even after they've been studying these creatures for such a long time, nobody's ever really certain. They're still just giving their best guess the whole time based on the info they have. And that, to me, was a really good representation of how this works normally. Now, having said all this, I understand, and I think we all understand why they do it, because the scientific process is test, repeat, you know, confirm hypotheses. It's not, you know, cinematic stuff.
Well, it's not conducive to keep a story going in a 2.5-hour time slot.
Yeah.
True.
We do get that.
Well, I think that's what I was saying earlier. Like, there is a balance, right? Like, you have to recognize that this is a movie, it's not real, or it's a TV show, it's not real. But at the same time, especially if you are trying to base a movie more in reality, you have to not just completely throw out the laws of everything we know to be true.
I could have been the advisor on that film, and the film would have been 100 times better. That's how much I knew about black holes in high school relative to this movie.
My biggest pet peeve that immediately takes me out of any kind of movie I'm watching is when someone whips out a fucking microscope in the middle of nowhere and puts, they decide to mount, I don't know how they set up, but they mount their little slide ever so perfectly, and they put usually a drop of blood or any some kind of sample on it, and they look underneath it. And then you see on screen this amazing image, high definition, probably scanning electron microscope type level image of whatever they're looking at. And whatever they're looking at is also moving around, replicating, changing, blah, blah, blah. Fucking The Predator, Shane Black's 2018 horrendous movie, which I have another issue with that we'll talk about. Fucking Olivia Munn's character just has a drop of, I think it's Predator blood. I don't know. This movie was bounced off my brain because of how bad it was. She sits down in this RV, pulls out her microscope, which is a compound microscope. This is not a crazy, powerful, super high definition thing. This is something you can look at, you know, anywhere from 10 to about 400 times magnification. A cell is fucking small, and your blood is made up of cells. You're not going to see it if you zoom in 400 times. You need a very powerful, very technical microscope to do this.
How do you feel about the 1980s version of The Thing?
Right? I was going to bring that up.
Okay, good.
I think, because I thought about that while I was ranting, and I think that's, for me, a good example where this is less of Walter, oh, fuck, what's his name? Wilford Brimley. Looking at it under a microscope, but he feeds the data into a computer, and the computer then presents a simulation of what is happening, which to me is a lot better because it's not actually him seeing this happen in real time in a scope that cannot do it. Exactly. This is him having some kind of hypothesis or some kind of idea of what he thinks is happening, and maybe having, for whatever reason, because they're all supposed to be scientists, this, except for Kurt Russell, the amazing man with his beautiful hair, they have some kind of powerful computer that can model these things. So he feeds it in there, and then it just models this scenario for him of it taking over. And then extrapolating a little bit too far to be like, hey, it's taking over the entire cell, and it could take over the entire planet in like 4 months. So watch out. So that's a bit too far, but the representation's fine.
This is a very pithy, like, trivial comment, but I think for me, with the microscope thing, I remember from back in, you know, junior high school days and handling that kind of equipment, those little slides are fucking fragile. Like,
it's a thin thing of glass.
Yeah. I mean, I remember breaking some because they were, you know, more fragile than you would expect. So, like, that they just pull out the pocket microscope and the pocket slide and just do some science.
I would love to see 2 minutes of somebody, like, with their little pipette being like, fucking broken this one. Can I have a new slide?
Exactly.
Can you please hand me a new slide? No, put the gloves on first. You'll get your finger oil on the slides. Please, just...
No, kids. Don't put your fucking slide on the table. Put a paper towel on first so you don't scratch this fine glass. Students that I taught during my PhD. Yeah. Stop doing this. Stop breaking everything. Oh my God, why aren't you listening to me? Flashbacks, trauma, all of it.
Yeah.
I feel like this microscope thing is the same issue that software developers have with the hacker scene where they're like, you know, like T-Rex handing five screens, all binary code on all of them, you know, numbers flashing by.
I will say this is something that, and to be fair, I hated, we've talked about this before, I fucking hated molecular biology, but this is something that I just, like, I push it out of my mind. I'm like, that's wrong, but fuck it, who cares? This is one of those things that I'm just like, that doesn't bother me at all. What I do think that we should see more of, though, and I think Kirsty talked about this when we did Annihilation as well, is that quite often field biologists will take those things out into the field a lot of the time. It seems stupid, but it's a really useful tool. And we never see that anywhere. You never see, you know, a scientist bring out a little notebook with a pencil, because you can't use pen because what if it rains, and a little magnifying glass. And I would love to see more of that in, like, field biology. But yeah, a really good example would have been, for instance, Alien Covenant, when all those fucking morons, because they are just the dumbest people ever, go out onto that new planet. And that would be the perfect kind of environment when you're checking out new plants to bring field microscopes and journals, but no, they just eating and
just touching everything, taking your masks off, breathing this atmosphere that who knows what the fuck is in it.
Okay, I know this is amazing, but we are professionals, so let's be extra careful so that we can get all of the answers we have.
I'm pressing every button I can find.
I wanted to go over some story things that kind of annoy me. And by kind of, I mean a lot. First of all, it's just lazy writing. I think the thing that you have to recognize, and by you, I mean the collective you, is that everything has been done before, right? Like, art, there is no true art. That's not a unique philosophy from my standpoint. That's just the way it is with years and, you know, century of people creating and writing and sculpting and painting and composing. Everything's going to have an influence, right? You're always going to be sort of, not necessarily copying, but inspired. And then sometimes straight copying, you know, we talked about earlier on the season homages. So I think that for me, by understanding that rule, that there is nothing new, it then becomes the challenge to make it interesting, right? To put a new spin on it, to put, I shouldn't say the word new spin, because, right, nothing's new. So a fresh spin on it. And I think nothing annoys me more than just rinse and repeat stories where, and I think this happens more in TV shows, because I understand you have to churn episodes out. And you know, there's a lot stricter of deadlines with writing than there is for movies, you know, cause movies, you just kind of have your script and then it's done and you shoot, with the occasional rewrites. Whereas TV shows, you're filming and then writing and filming and writing, and it's constantly evolving. And I think it's so easy to just fall back into, well, I don't have anything new this week, or I'm not really that creatively inspired, so like, fuck it, we're just gonna copy this storyline or this plot line from thousands of other shows.
It's not like, is maybe not as black and white as what Libby's talking about, but I brought it up when we were, before we actually started the podcast, with the Marvel movies. A lot of the, within a series of a given Marvel character, the first movie is the same thing. Iron Man 1 is Iron Man versus Evil Iron Man. Black Panther is Black Panther versus Evil Black Panther. Ant-Man is Ant-Man versus Evil Ant-Man. It's just a character versus somebody else with the exact same powers as them. And often the first movie in these like heroes series is the exact same every time.
Yeah. How do we feel then about movies that, because we talked about this with Dune, right? The fact that it was reasonably original when it came out, but we've now seen so many things that were inspired by Dune that Dune feels very tired. Do you think Dune gets a pass because of this?
I mean, I think when we were talking about Dune, that's what I was saying, like, even the author himself has said that he was inspired by Arthurian legend, right? So, who saves the kingdom, you know? So I think what he did is he takes this old story and he makes it fresh. Like, he makes it new. If you look at anything, you can find where it's derived from. But when you are watching it, if you become so immersed in that world or lost in that story, then you've succeeded as a writer. And I think that Frank Herbert does that with Dune. You know, even in the books, I recognize plot devices, I recognize themes, but it still felt like a new world to me, even though logically, removing myself from the story, I know it's not new. It's not the first, you know, sci-fi planet that I've ever read about. It's not the first boy wonder who saved the world story that I've ever read about.
Yeah. Okay. Well, how about a movie that I think you quite like, The Host, that we did much earlier in the season, where, I mean, it is big monster as a result of pollution or bad man's actions, which all the time. Like, what do you think saves The Host? Because I agree that it's a fantastic movie.
I think for me, when you shift focus off of what is normally a trope, so you have the polluted monster ransacking the city, but if you look at The Host, it's not really about that. It's about a father and daughter, and I think that's what saves it, is because it takes an old trope, but it points the story in a new direction. So it's about this loser guy trying to be a better dad, and I think that's what makes it interesting. That's what makes it different.
I agree.
Yeah. Okay.
I think my other thing that I was going to say is for plot devices, characters existing in stories just for plot. And I do actually have an example for this one, and we'll talk about it in 2 weeks, would be Slither. So the girl who gets the worm down her throat, bites it, pulls it out, and then has these visions of the alien race, you know, taking over. I hate that. I hate that so much, because she's not a character before, and her only point as a character is to tell the other characters what is happening.
Yeah.
She is a plot device just to move the plot along, and nothing more. You don't care about her. You don't even know who she really is. And the main characters don't care about her, right? Like, she's just like, oh, we're just going to throw her in here to explain everything that's happening. And then that's what moves the story along.
And it's odd because that could have so easily just happened to Nathan Fillion's character.
Exactly. I think this ties into what you guys were saying earlier, is sometimes they do this with the science character. And, you know, and usually in movies, that's who the plot device is, right? You have this scientist who comes in. You don't really know anything about him, a character. He's just the smart person, or she's the smart person in the room, just explaining what's going on. And then they, like, deuce out and let the main characters do their thing.
Peter Capaldi and the Suicide Squad.
Exactly.
But I do want to... Let's bring up a really good example of this, though, where it really works. And I think that is The Troll Hunter, where... It's really natural in the plot for them to stop, have the troll hunter hand off a sample of blood to a doctor who he knows, and then for the cast to be like, the filming crew to be like, hey, can we interview you as part, can we interview you as part of this movie? Mm-hmm. I think that works really well, like really organically and naturally.
I think for me, it's easy to explain things without doing that, without having that plot trope character or plot device character. A great example, a movie we did recently is Cloverfield, right? Where you have things in the movie explaining what's going on. But the brilliant part about that movie is that for the most part, you don't fucking know, right? Like, you have no idea what's going on. And you don't have to. I think movies get stuck in their scripts of trying to explain everything to their audience. But we don't need to know everything. I think there's a beauty to being kept in the dark because it makes us more intrigued in figuring out what is going on and trying to figure it out for ourselves. I know a lot of people aren't a big fan of movies that have vague endings, but I love them. I like movies that make you think. I'll say that there is a fine line to that. But for the most part, I like movies that make you think and get you to look inside your own head as to what the answer is, rather than just spell everything out for you like you're a kindergartner.
Yeah.
The most frustrating thing ever, especially in fucking video games. Sorry.
Exactly.
I will say with Cloverfield that I went online and there were a bunch of people who were just like, yeah, didn't you hear TJ Miller's character? It came from under the sea. And I'm just like, that's the answer?
I mean...
He's drunkenly ranting in a subway. You didn't know
it's an answer. Is it the right one? Who fucking knows? But he has as much information as you do, which is nice.
Yeah.
And I think a cousin to that is, I don't like when a movie or show has spent an entire... you know, season or an entire hour establishing a character and who they are and what they do and what their motives are. And then you have them do something absolutely off brand just to keep the plot going, right? If you're going to take the time to build a character, then have the character do something that they would do. Don't just do it to fucking move the plot along.
Want is external, need is internal. The external want of a character is what drives the plot forward. This is Frodo wanting to destroy the ring, Woody wanting to become Andy's favorite toy again, or Neo wanting to save humanity from the grips of our mechanical overlords.
So, just as a last quick one, and we did, Dave and Adam did talk about this 2-3 years ago when we did this sort of episode the first time. An animal roaring before it strikes or before it attacks or bites or whatever. Now, I think the example that we talked about, that Adam and Dave talked about last time, was the T-Rex in Jurassic Park. It is constantly doing this, like roaring before it attacks, roaring while it's chasing. As you guys said last time, ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. But there are some scenes in movies where it makes sense. We've talked about this a bunch on this podcast, the fact that big animals, whether they're herbivores fighting over a mate, whether they're carnivores fighting over a mate, whether they're carnivores trying to establish dominance in a pack.
Mates fighting over a carnivore.
Mother protecting her babies.
Yeah. What they do not want to fight. The first thing they will do most of the time is just posture. Sometimes it won't even get to that. Sometimes they'll have antlers like moose that automatically tell you who's got the bigger dick to swing around. No, you don't even need that posturing in some cases. But if it does come to posturing, lots of species do, you know, roar and make sound. We talked earlier about we talked earlier in the year about Diane Fossey. A lot of her, a lot of the records she took of guerrillas talked about, you know, the clashes between guerrilla troops, how they'll just, you know, scream and yell at each other for ages before any fighting happens. So in that sense, what Kong does across pretty much all representations, the chest beating, the roaring, that I've always been fine with, because it's a guerrilla trying to intimidate something, trying to make it back down. Another more, well, more and less hominid at the same time example is the Predator. They're constantly just yelling, even when they're still definitely going in for the kill. Arnie gets screamed at a bunch by that thing. But that makes sense. They're trying to intimidate something that they're about to go up against. I have no problem with that.
No, it works. It's a being big thing. It's a being mean thing. It's a challenge. Or in the case of, I don't know if we see it too much in monster movies, but I know like a good example of animals making noise in nature at least is like snakes with a rattlesnake rattling its tail or something hissing at you. It's like, stay away from me because I don't want to deal with you. But if you do, I will fuck you up.
Yeah. I'm here.
That's what Adam does whenever there's one slice of pizza left. He'll just stand over it and rattle.
There's never a slice of pizza left because I already ate it while screaming.
Another silly example of this, though, is one that we want to talk about soon because we know it's kind of a bad film, but it's still a lot of fun, is the Wrath of the, or the Clash of the Titans. Whichever one the Kraken's in.
Clash of the Titans.
When the Kraken rises from the deep and just roars at a city of ants, like, even if you're going out with, like, you know, a bunch of ant spray, right? You don't scream at the ants before you start spraying them.
I don't know if I could stand by that. I feel like I've seen plenty of people just losing their mind because of the press problem and just deciding they're going to unleash their wrath of God on these small, puny creatures that are just trying to live their lives.
I think some people might, like, I don't want to speak for everyone, but I think that having that immediacy to me is much more horrifying. You know, I always think of the movie like Ghosts in the Darkness, right? Where if the lions were fucking roaring and like puffing up before they attacked, it would be kind of boring. The whole reason that movie is horrifying is because they steal in and you can't hear them and you can't see them and you're dead.
Yeah. And another good example from, I think we did this in season 3, is Attack the Block. The big gorilla wolf motherfuckers. Yep. They're not roaring at you. And they've got the teeth for it. They do a bit of snarling, but they are just,
coming
constantly.
In it.
Yeah. The only time one roars, I think, is when it's backed into a corner by a couple of the kids.
And there's a few times where it does a cheesy roar, but it's not nearly as often as as most monster movies like to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I will also say that a lot of these monsters probably don't have the vocal cords necessary to make these kind of sounds. There's some new research out that says the T-Rex might have sounded a little bit more like a duck than a mouse. I mean, they're very closely related to birds, right? I mean, birds are dinosaurs. When the fuck was the last time you heard a bird roar?
Yeah, no. I heard some cats going at it today when I was having my lunch at a cafe here, so that was quite the sound.
That's a horrifying noise.
Yeah. It's a really horrifying noise. Yeah. I just don't even know what
but
the fuck
I feel
fuck
like
is
Jurassic Park did a good job with the velociraptors doing the little, like, haw, haw. Like, that was very bird-like to me.
Yeah.
And they didn't roar. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Agreed.
That was really cool. But can you imagine the T-Rex making the same sound?
Yes. And it'd be wonderful.
Caw-caw! Caw-caw! Yeah.
I mean, there is a certain gravitas that can be lent to a movie with this kind of great sound design. The one that always comes to mind is not quite a monster movie, but War of the World, 2005 War of the Worlds with Tom Cruise. One of the best examples of Tom Cruise running in a movie. But those like air horn noises that those alien machines make it scared the fuck out of me when I was watching that movie. Not that it's a scary movie, but it's just like, Jesus, if I heard that, I would just kill myself. There's no point in trying to fight that.
I think to
just end yourself. Just
I think to your point, it's like, and to what I was saying earlier is like, be creative with it. We've heard a lion roar and a fucking gorilla roar 1,000 times, and we don't need another sound mashup of those types of roars. There are plenty of other sounds that can be terrifying,
like a fart.
Let's do that.
I
actually really like the new Godzilla, mainly from the 2014 one. I like the Godzilla roars that we get these days. Sounds a bit like an elephant sometimes. Mm-hmm.
It's like the classic roar, isn't it?
What Sam's talking about, it's got that like, like in it, like the...
Yeah. The kind of screech more than a roar.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
Give us a big, loud roar.
Mr. Waternoose, there's no time for
this. Come on, come on, what are you waiting for? Roar!
But sir!
Roar!
Oh, I have one more movie trope that I have to say that annoys the ever-loving piss out of me.
The ever-loving piss?
Real Sophia Eurista in this bitch.
Stop putting makeup on women actors when they do not need to have full face makeup on.
Yeah.
There is a movie. Hold on, let me look this up.
While you're looking that up, I was watching The Harder They Fall last night. Or The Harder They Fall 2 nights ago. Zazie Beetz strolls into town at some point after she's been like riding hard for 3-4 days across the countryside. Presumably she doesn't have lipstick with her, but she still looks like dirty and sweaty, but she's still got the full face of makeup on. I'm like, why?
No.
My prime example is the movie The Martian. Okay. You have Matt Damon, and you have Kate Mara, both astronauts. In this entire movie, the makeup team does a phenomenal job of making Matt Damon look like absolute dog shit, right?
Yup.
He looks so bad in that movie, and that's incredible because you believe that he would look like that. And then you have Kate Mara running on a treadmill in space with fucking mascara and a full face of makeup on. I'm sorry, but fuck you.
What do you hate more? Do you hate boobs on female armor or the makeup thing more?
Oh, man. I think the makeup thing. I just can't, you know, with the boobs on armor, at least it's not their decision, right? It's someone, unless they're the armor maker, but it's someone giving them that armor, and it's like, great, it has boobs. But with the makeup thing, you're telling me that that was Kate Mara's decision to be like, I'm gonna go up in space, can't forget my mascara, you know? Like, fuck off, she's not thinking about that.
Like bloody mascara, because they're on Mars.
The joke was out of this world.
Yeah. Universally appreciated.
No, categorically false. Turns out.
Adam's ejected himself from this conversation.
Yeah. Been injecting myself this whole time.
All right. So, Adam, what are we doing next week?
Next week, we're going to be looking at Shang-Chi and the apparently variety of creatures that are in this movie that I have yet to see and / did not expect.
I'm excited. Yeah. I haven't seen it either.
Yeah, you see, you glimpse a couple of them very slightly in the trailer.
I don't know if I watched the full trailer.
Yeah, don't. Just go into it fresh. It's great fun.
That's the plan. So yeah, Shang-Chi next week. Then we'll the redo with Slither Sigler the week after that. And then Antlers, a movie I've been looking forward to since before the pandemic. So it's supposed to come out in fall 2019.
Fuck off, was it?
Something like that. Or maybe it was spring 2020. But pandemic fucked it up royally. Regardless. Shang-Chi next week. As we say here at the end of every episode, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
And don't forget your mascara. Bye.